Hello and welcome to the Politically Speaking Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Chris McDaniel, a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio, and joining me today...
Jason Rosenbaum of the St. Louis Beacon.
And...
Joe Manis of the St. Louis Beacon.
We might be a little bit tired this week because we stayed up very late on Tuesday night for the mayoral election.
11:30.
I didn't get home until like 12:30 or 1,
well,
but
yeah.
I had to get
you
together
were on
audio.
The scene.
Yeah, you were on the scene.
I was writing it from my red couch, so there was a difference there.
Yeah. That's but to be fair, you two did both wake up early to go out and
yes,
see
we
the
did.
Vote, so.
Yes, we did.
Because we knew that because of staffing limitations that we weren't going to be able to get out to the events Tuesday night, so we made up for it by being up...
And when Joe broached this idea, my first instinct was like, what? I don't want to wake up that early. Yeah. But I'm really glad I did, because not only did I get a few pictures of the mayor voting, which is always good, but, you know, I think that helped. It's just good to see the candidates in their element right before an election. So,
well, at least our readers who went on our site on Tuesday morning because most of them go up. Probably visit it between 8 or later in the morning. We already had all that stuff online because both of the candidates decided to vote between 6 and 6:30 in the morning at their respective polling places. And we each got a little FaceTime with them as well.
But I can tell you the two votes did not make a difference in this race.
It did not. Well, let's talk a little bit about the results. Slay won by about 10 points. He is ahead after... the absentee ballots, and he was never really fretting it.
But I must say, and I think that some of the coverage, not yours, Chris, but some of the coverage outside of this room, kind of missed a couple things. First, 10 points when, okay, the mayor got 54% of the vote. Mm-hmm. Considering the fact that he outspent Reed by more than 4-1, had a much stronger ground game, because Reed's ground game, depending on who you talk to, definitely wasn't as strong as the mayor's. Let's put it that way. And the mayor had many major officials, African-American officials behind him as well as others, Lacey Clay. The fact that the mayor got 54% of the vote, he beat Reed by 4,500 votes. That's not huge.
Right.
I mean, it makes you – I think the mayor deserves points in that a lot of people thought he was doing overkill.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, if he hadn't spent all that money, had all those fancy ads, and had that strong ground game, he might have lost. I suspect that maybe – I may get jumped on about this from his camp, but I suspect that they had hoped that he would at least get in the high 50% range, like 57, 58.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, 54, it's comfortable, but it's not that comfortable.
Right. But I have to say – Lewis Reed, and we'll probably talk about him, is a different candidate than Maida Coleman or Irene Smith was.
Right.
Both of those two were hugely long-shot candidates that had even less money than Reed in many respects. So I think there was an expectation that Reed would do better, because we've said on this podcast a million times he was his strongest challenger since 2001.
Yeah, but he had some weaknesses in his campaign.
Yeah,
I mean, frankly, strategically,
campaign was kind of backwards.
Yes, they didn't do hardly any TV until the very, very end.
Mm-hmm.
They, like his issues papers, he puts them out the last week.
Right.
And by that point, all the profiles, all of the major broader pieces by most of the news outlets, including both of ours, have already been put to bed. I mean, we're dealing with the day-to-day stuff at the end.
Yeah. And continue.
Yeah, he raised about $625,000,
right,
and only $5,000 was spent on TV ads, and those were only on Charter.
Yeah.
And that's pretty surprising.
I will say something else, and I know that St. Louis County and St. Louis City are different, but I think these examples are apt in this instance, and I think this is one of the reasons Reed, from a, you know, just an issue standpoint, fell short of Slay. He basically started, you know, criticizing and launching missives at Slay's administration either right before he started to run or during. Before then, there wasn't a lot of instances where Reed was out there pointing out where the mayor was doing something wrong.
Correct.
If you look in St. Louis County, for example, there's a possibility there could be a primary between St. Louis County Executive Charlie Dooley and Councilman Steve Stenger of South County. Stenger has been criticizing the way Dooley has been operating for like 3 or 4 years now.
Right.
And he would be able to say, hey, look at this point in 2011 or 2010 or 2012 where I pointed out how I would do something differently. And while this is probably more inside baseball than anything, when you're trying to convince a large block of voters to dump an incumbent for somebody new, number one, you have to prove the incumbent isn't worth being in office, but you got to prove that you'd be different from him. And I don't think that Reid really put that forward enough and strongly.
Well, his issues papers, I think, should have come out earlier, much earlier, you know, when he first started. And, okay, maybe he can do some attacks against the mayor, but he needed to have that early so at least people, when they're hearing Reid, they have a sense of what he's for. Because if you're just attacking the mayor or whoever, like Stinger, at least people know what Stinger is for.
Yeah.
They may or may not agree with him. But Reid, I don't think, did a strong enough job, especially until the last week or two, of saying, here is what I'm for, and here is where I disagree with the mayor. And by the way, I think the mayor is crooked or whatever, you know, because he did throw out all that stuff. So, but by failing to define himself and just attacking the mayor constantly, I think Reid became more of a cipher. I think he was hoping that he would just get all this anti-Slay vote by making all about Slay. Well, all you have to do is look at the Romney-Obama election last year to see how that worked out, where if you don't define yourself early on, which Romney didn't, you get defined by your opponent. And now what Slay, though, chose to do was mainly to run – well, all of his ads were positive –
except for the mailers.
Except for the mailers.
Well, I'm talking about the ads as opposed to the mailers. The TV stuff that everybody saw was very positive. The mailers, which went to the particular targeted voters, was a different story. But he did his attacks that way. The mayor didn't do any press conferences saying this or that about Reid. So you could really see a difference in strategy and I think the results show that actually it probably paid off. That and the mayor having such a strong ground game that day with having these people in the various polling places who – now I know what scratchers means.
Not lottery tickets.
Yeah, it's not lottery tickets. It's people who had these computer devices, I'm assuming iPads or something, and they would mark off people as they came in because they had a list of about 21,000 people that were – identified from phone banking last spring as being extremely pro-Slay. So they had them rated like in a between 1 and 4. And so the 1s and 2s, they wanted to make sure they got out. And if by a certain time they hadn't, then these people would get reached by phone banks again on Tuesday. And they even had, in some cases, people going door to door to these households, particular households, saying, we know you haven't voted yet. Do you need help? Do you need a ride? This and that. That ended up being extremely crucial when you look at the results.
Well, let's look at the map, for example.
Excellent map, by the way, by Brent Jones.
Yeah, we'll link to that on our show page.
Okay, so Reid, you know, clobbered Slay in some of the North Side wards. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the turnout there, first of all, and I'm just doing this as a preface, I don't think you can compare 2013 to 2009 primary because the 2009 primary had different ward maps. And that was not the main attraction that year. That was the general election. I had a hard time comparing this race. So one race that I did compare it to, while it's not a completely congruent one because the turnout was different, was the Russ Carnahan-Lacey Clay race. And you look at how Reid did all over the map and you saw how Clay and Carnahan did. First of all, yes, Reid did better in the north side. He won a bunch of awards up there, but the turnout numbers were not particularly high. Some of them were below the 22% city average.
Plus, he got 80% of the vote. Now, 80% of the vote north side, if you're an African-American candidate, actually isn't – it's not bad, but it's not great.
By comparison, Russ Carnahan in the 4th Ward got 6% of the vote.
Lacey Clay got over 90%.
And that was replicated elsewhere. You know, Slay got, I think, anywhere from like 19-20%.
Right.
That's nothing to be proud of, per se, but – It is notable in many respects.
It cuts the margins. And when you look at the fact that, as I said, the mayor only carried 4,500 citywide.
That helps.
That helps. You get maybe you know, you cut the margin by 50 votes here, 100 votes there.
Yeah, right.
That adds up.
And then Reid didn't win the Central Corridor, which he needed to do.
Right.
And then most importantly, I think, if you look at the South City.
Especially Southwest.
Southwest. 16th Ward, the 12th, and the
23rd. The 23rd.
All those had over 30% turnout. And Slay won all those by over 80%. I think that was the key to victory. We kind of talked offline about whether maybe Republicans may have voted in those wards, because those are three wards where
I believe they did.
Where, you know, a lot of Republicans reside. I think that it's highly possible that they did, because there's no Republican right. on the ballot.
Right.
And I mean, as I've said on this podcast, I don't think Reid did anything to help himself with that voting block. In fact, I think
no, he hurt himself.
I think in some instances with his public statements, he kind of went out of his way to alienate that potential voting
yes.
block. But, you know, I think that those were kind of the reasons why it all worked out this way. And while the 2012 primary, Democratic primary and this primary had different sets of voters and had more races in that one, I do think that it is notable that, you know, the North St. Louis wards and some of the South St. Louis wards, which have African-American pluralities, they didn't turn out nearly as much. And actually, the 16th Ward, where I happen to live, their turnout this time around was actually better than in August. So that was an interesting thing to see.
Well, that shows the strength, A, of the mayor's ground game as opposed to Russ Carnahan's ground game last summer. And but I think also Reid had been going into this race. He had been seen somewhat as a transformational figure potentially. And he highlighted at the forum. I want to emphasize he highlighted this. OK, the fact that his wife is white. So he was trying to point out that he was not. But, you know, that he was wanting to represent everybody in the city.
And he's basically a Southsider.
Correct.
So it's a misnomer to say, you know, he got right. all these North Side.
But some of the rhetoric that came out of his campaign was the type of stuff that would turn off city voters from the Southwest part of the city. Not necessarily from him, but from some of the supporters. And then when you have Clay, Jamila Nasheed, who's the state senator, you have Charlie Dooley, who's the county executive, and these are all three top African-American officials in the region. Plus, you had on the Board of Aldermen, a sizable chunk of the African-American aldermen were with Slay. So it became, I think, kind of an odd campaign in that the effort was to make it not racial, but then in some ways it ended up being somewhat racial. It was, and I think that hurt him in the Central Corridor. If you go back 20 years, when Freeman Bosley won and became the first African-American mayor, Freeman Bosley, who then was the circuit clerk, succeeded in particularly wooing white voters in the Central Corridor and did quite well. And he also benefited because the Board of Aldermen president that year, Tom Villa, who had been expected to win for mayor, that vote was split with State Rep Tony Roboto, who was from the Southwest part of the city. So the white vote was split. But the point was that Bosley tried to come across as a transformational figure. Now, by 4 years later, he was not seen as that for various controversies in his administration. And that's how Clarence Harmon, who was then the police chief, who was an African-American, came in and had like 90% of the vote in South St. Louis and had a huge Republican surge that came out for him. So, I mean, in some ways, racial politics has always been going on in St. Louis ever since I can remember, but it doesn't always play out according to the script.
Yeah, and I don't know how much the Clay and Nasheed helped, but it certainly didn't help Reid that they were in Slay's corner.
Well, I think, as I said, it's just a little bit, getting 20% as opposed to the 5% for Russ Carnahan. I mean, every little bit helps, and this also sets up what's going to happen in 2 years. Reid is still the Board of Aldermen president. Again, this is a similar situation to Villa and Bosley 20 years ago, and what's going to happen, I mean, there may be an effort for Slay and Reid to work together. Maybe there won't be. The fact that Darlene Green, the comptroller, who is also African-American, stayed neutral, stayed out of it, that's key. You wonder what's going to happen there. Is Slay's camp going to come up with someone to challenge Reed in 2 years?
Well, I think he will.
Reed told me that he will absolutely continue running for mayor. But in terms of whether or not that's even feasible
he has to win re-election.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't have an opponent a couple years ago, but I think that, you know, after this, somebody might run against him and they might be a serious opponent. That's just my guess.
Right, right. And whether or not it wins or loses, it does keep him busy. And then you have to look at, well, is the mayor going to be trying to considering a fifth term, or will you have somebody like Circuit Attorney Jennifer Joyce looking at running for mayor?
Well, let's shift the topic to some other Democrats here.
Sir, we've been obsessed with this.
Yeah, the Democrats, they're all over the place. Because, Joe, you were at Democrat Days.
Yes.
Over the past week.
23rd year.
23rd year. How did it compare to Lincoln Days?
Okay, well, Democrat Days is a little different. Okay. Lincoln Days, as we mentioned several weeks ago, is the big Republican event. It's statewide, but it floats between St. Louis, Kansas City, and Springfield, and it was held this winter in St. Louis. Democrat Days is a little different. Democrat Days is a regional event in Hannibal. The Democrats, and this kind of speaks to the Democrats, rather than having one statewide event, have a bunch of regional events. So Democrat Days is sort of like New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to run for something in a year or two, you show up at Democrat Days. Now, because it was an off year, it wasn't like a huge crowd. It wasn't as big a crowd as I've seen some years. But it is the place where Bill Clinton showed up 20 years ago when he needed stuff. It's the place where Bill Bradley made his last stand in 2000 trying to get some support. So Democrat Days has some history to it. Well, in this case, here's how it was used. Democrat Days, at the eternal brunch, which usually lasts 2 or 3 hours, it always spotlights key speakers. The governor spoke, but the governor was not the key speaker. It was Secretary of State Jason Kander. It was his first major political address since he took office. And Jason Kander showed a talent for the jab. I've never seen anybody who compared the Medicaid expansion opposition to the opponents of the Louisiana Purchase. And it actually went over well. And he made some jabs saying that the Medicaid expansion was the best deal Missouri has seen since, quote, France sold us for 3 cents an acre. But the crowd loves that kind of stuff. Kander, it was a very rather sophisticated speech. I said the governor was there. The governor gave his standard address in which he did not use the words Democrat or Republican in his remarks, even though it's in a partisan crowd. But I want to emphasize that's the governor's standard. Yeah. The governor generally doesn't do that. Then at the banquet, which, again, had a somewhat smaller crowd than in recent years, Chris Koster, Attorney General, was the MC. Koster has been who changed parties in 2007, still trying to
shock the world.
Yeah. And so he's still trying to get Democrats to accept him.
I would hope they've accepted him by now because he's probably going to run for governor soon.
See, Hannibal, the good thing about Hannibal is, okay, Northeast Missouri used to be rural Democratic.
Up until 2 years ago.
Right. Now it's in 2012, even though there was statewide Democratic doing well, Northeast Missouri they were decimated.
Yeah, and actually I wanted to touch on this because I have followed, believe it or not, even though I'm a city slicker from Chicago suburbs, I've actually followed Northeast Missouri politics pretty closely for the last few years. And it is kind of interesting because in 2006 they had a really good year. Like, they had a bunch of state reps.
Right.
They got a state Senate seat. And in 2010, their ranks were thinned considerably.
Yes.
And in 2012, Paul Quinn and Tom Shively both lost, leaving Ed Schieffer of Lincoln County as the only person you could consider as an elected
Correct.
Representative from
Correct.
There. So they have been decimated over the last couple of election cycles, the Democrats there. And you were at a press conference where Schieffer announced he was going to run for the 10th District Senate seat, which encompasses a few
Correct.
Rural Missouri counties, and also Jeff Rorta in Jeffco.
Right. He announced he's going to run for the state Senate to seat Ryan McKenna.
I would expect, you know, it's interesting. Those are two seats that are held by a Democrat, and I bet both of them will be highly contested by Republicans. I'm not even really sure that Rorta is going to be able to just go into that without a primary.
Correct.
I think that there could be others that go into there, but I noticed that there was nobody who announced for Brian Munslinger's seat and nobody who's announced against John Lamping, which are two seats that are held by Republicans that are considered, I don't know, maybe on the borderline of being competitive. So if they want to gain ground in places like Northeast Missouri, I mean, Schieffer is definitely one of the people that can try to do that because, you know, that's at least a credible candidate in there. But they're going to need to do a whole lot more if they want to gain ground in the Senate. So.
But it also is a place, though, for candidates like, let's say, Koster, who's widely believed to be running for governor in 2016, to sort of at least reach out to whatever rural Democrats there are and to kind of get his bona fides.
Because he's done well there.
Right. And Koster, I will not repeat his joke, but he was explaining about going to his first Democrat days in 2008, and I remember that he brought his mother. And anyway, he's talking about being in the car, and he opens up his speech by talking about being in the car with his mother. I will not use the language on the air, but the point was his mother got into this whole soliloquy, which he says he's heard a million times, but he had staff people in the car. She's talking about when he was born, and let's put it this way. He was a breech birth. His rear came out first. And so he asked his mom, "Mom, don't talk about this. What does this have to do with Democrat days?" And she gave a rather earthy response. So let's put it that way. So the audience roared. The audience rather loved it. That's the kind of stuff that plays well in rural Missouri. But he was not the star of the Democrat days, either the banquet or of the weekend. The star was the director of agriculture, who most of our listeners probably have not heard of, John Hagler, who he's somewhat of a character, wears a cowboy hat, fairly young.
Yeah, but he also has a doctorate in political science
Correct.
From Washington University, and so he's no dummy.
And he's married to state Rep. Linda Black.
Yeah.
From rural Missouri. Hagler did take his cowboy hat off for his speech, but he went into this whole, he says he has a Pentecostal background, went into this whole amazing speech talking about what Democrats stand for, the working man, and he had this cadence going on. The audience was on their feet twice, cheering, and there was also some it was just amazing. And he also told a number of earthy farm stories, which I will not relate, but one of them I did use at the end of my story. So people, if they go to our website and click on my name, you can find at least part of Hagler's speech. But I will tell this one little thing that was not in my story that gives you an example of how the Democrats, I think, are grooming him to run for something. Koster told a story to the crowd about how he'd recently had been at the state fair and he'd been in the governor's box. And here's the governor and all these big shots watching some act on the grandstand. And a fight breaks out at the bottom of the grandstand. And they're watching this. And all of a sudden, Koster told the crowd, he said, all of a sudden, this tall guy with a cowboy hat jumps up and horizontally flies over the fighters and comes down right on top of them. And somebody says, "Who's that?" And allegedly the governor replied, "I think that's my director of agriculture." And then Hagler came walking into the governor's booth, slapped his cowboy hat on the side of his slacks to get the dust off, and said, quote, "I'll be damned if somebody's going to fight at my state fair."
I'll just say, just briefly, because I think we're running out of time here. I think it's, you know, the Department of Ed had kind of gone through a few directors under Matt Blunt. I think Hagler has been there the whole time.
Yes, he has.
He was instrumental in forging a compromise on dog breeding regulation, legislation, which I think endeared him to rural Missouri. And when I was talking about Linda Black running for Congress, I was pointing to him as a real asset for her because I think he has a lot of popularity in some of the rural parts. So I do think that they might be grooming him for something. He's somebody to watch for sure. And the fact that he wears an awesome cowboy hat certainly doesn't hurt.
Yeah, and he does. And now he was also saying that his, he was promoting his wife as potential as running on the ticket. He mentioned that too. But I got to say, it's been a long time since I've seen a Democrat Days crowd go this wild over somebody, and afterwards they're flocking him afterwards to talk to him.
Well, let's talk very briefly, just a minute or two, about some Republicans here. Lieutenant Governor Peter Kinder is asked to speak with Governor Jay Nixon, but apparently, according to Joe's story, that might not be happening.
No, the governor, Kinder has taken a stand in support of this lawsuit, and Jason can chime in on this part, that had been filed by a gun owner in Stoddard County, which is in rural Missouri, who wanted to get his concealed carry permit, and he wanted it marked on his driver's license. Mm-hmm. And so he went into the DOR to get his paper. He had brought all his paperwork, and he was shocked and upset and left because they were going to scan, like, his birth certificate and other stuff into a database, which mm-hmm. is then eventually it ends up where the federal government has access to it. This guy has filed suit challenging the retention of all this private documentation and claims that this may be tied to an effort for the federal government to monitor gun purchases. Now, key aspect here, this practice is in line with the 2005 passage in Congress under George W. Bush of the Real ID Act, which was aimed at tracking people who got driver's licenses to make sure that no terrorists got driver's licenses, because one of the 9/11 hijackers ended up, he had four driver's licenses, fraudulent. So this was part of that. But, okay, so the gentleman goes to court. A judge issues a restraining order. And Jason, you want to talk about who the judge was?
Former Senate President Pro Tem Rob Mayer, a Republican from Dexter, who was elected recently as a Stoddard County judge.
Yes. So now that's in the courts. Kinder and Tim Jones, House Speaker, have a press conference lauding what this guy's trying to do. They want to pass a law blocking the retention of this information. They say that this also violates a 2009 state law that they say curbs some of this retention of information. Kinder wanted to talk to Nixon about it. Nixon's staff says it isn't going to happen. Nixon isn't commenting. Now, if there had been a meeting, from what I understand, and I've been monitoring this for several years, that would have been the first meeting, private meeting ever, between the governor and the lieutenant governor since the governor took office in 2009.
They are not close. And in fact, it's night and day between how Matt Blunt and Peter Kinder operated and Jay Nixon and Peter Kinder operated. He is the I'm almost hesitant to use this term because it's not a fair comparison, but he's been in two different administrations, kind of like John Calhoun was vice president. He's not the same as John Calhoun. I'm not saying that Peter Kinder is a, you know, racist or segregationist like that.
But this goes back to the early days of our country where you had John Adams was president and Thomas Jefferson, who had lost to him, was the vice president. So you've got this. I mean, in Missouri is one of the few states remaining where the lieutenant governor and the governor run separately. So this is not unusual. We had Harriet Woods, who was lieutenant governor under John Ashcroft, and then Mel Carnahan under John Ashcroft, and they hated each other. And actually, there was a court fight over what Carnahan could do as lieutenant governor when Ashcroft was out of the state. But anyway, the bottom line is there is no love lost between Kinder and Nixon, and they aren't going to be talking about this or any other issue.
Well, we've gone on a little bit long this week, but we're going to have to cut it off there.
A lot to talk about.
There was a lot to talk about. You can read all of our stories, including the very handy infographic made by the St. Louis Beacon's Brent Jones, which is very good. It includes the margin of victory in the different wards, but what's even more revealing and more useful is the turnout in those specific wards. You can find that. We'll link to it on our show page. You can follow me on Twitter at CS McDaniel. You can follow Jason on Twitter at
J Rosenbaum.
You can follow Joe at
J Mannies. It's JMANNIES.
We'll be back next week with more political stories. Until then, so long.
So long. Jason, do you want to say?
Oh, I'm actually going on vacation until March 8th. Oh, well, this is the first time we've broken our so long meme. But I'm actually going to Italy tomorrow.
But we'll try to reach him.
No, in fact, I've been told that I have to switch my cell phone off or I'm going to be charged thousands of dollars.
We can Skype. Don't worry.
I'm not bringing my computer. I'm not bringing my iPad.
Okay.
I've been banned from doing that. I'm going to Italy and I'm tuning out, which is going to be a real difficult experience, but hopefully I'll meet the new Pope while I'm there.
and then we'll
report
report back. We'll have a great podcast then.
It'll be politically speaking Pope edition. So
Popeitically speaking.
Pope.
All right. Well, now for real. So long.
So long.
Arrivederci.